This is Dan, a high school teacher in New Jersey, and I love listening to and learning from the School of Practice podcast on Edutopia Radio.
Dr. Lori Santos is known as the happiness professor.
Is it possible to teach someone to be happier? To take the latest science and apply it in our lives in a way that has real impact? I'm Dr. Lori Santos. As a professor at Yale, I was...
Lori is a cognitive scientist. She also hosts the hit podcast, The Happiness Lab, which you just heard. And she teaches The Psychology of Happiness, which is the most popular class ever in Yale's history. But back in 2020, at the height of the pandemic, she was starting to notice something troubling about her own happiness.
I was feeling really emotionally exhausted. I was feeling like my entire role was really ineffective. But what was worse was that I was really feeling a sense of what clinical researchers call depersonalization, which is basically just cynicism. The kids are getting on your every last nerve.
Lori is one of the world's leading researchers on the science of happiness. So she recognized these are key symptoms of burnout. At the time, things were especially stressful for her. She was living in a campus dorm and serving as the head of college. So on top of teaching and hosting her podcast, it was also her job to support students through the pandemic, day to day.
And I remember this one moment in particular where a student had emailed me about a financial situation he was going through. He needed an emergency dental surgery, which is something in our roles as heads of college that we know we have a fund that we can use to help students out with that. And my instant reaction upon getting this email wasn't a sense of compassion for the student, like, oh my gosh, that must suck in the middle of midterms, you have to get a root canal. My instant reaction was like, oh, what a pain in the butt that is. Like, now I have to send this other email. And I was like, whoa, like, that is not like
a pain in the butt for you as the educator, right?
Exactly. So that for me was a moment where I was like, wait a minute, I need to take a break. I realized I needed to make some big changes.
I'm Kristen Leong, an editor at Edutopia, and I'm also a former middle school teacher. What Lori is describing may sound all too familiar for many of us. According to a 2025 RAND survey of 1,400 teachers, about half reported feelings of burnout. Now, Lori was able to make some changes. She stepped away from some of her duties, and she says long-term wellness is also about making changes in our day-to-day habits and mindsets. But she's not talking about yoga or bubble baths.
Sometimes I talk to people who are, you know, going through a tough time like this, and they're like, well, I'm trying to, you know, boost up my yoga or like get to the gym more or like hang out more with friends. And all of those things are awesome at the individual level. They will let you build the resilience to cope. But ultimately, they kind of might be more of a Band-Aid on some of the structural and occupational issues that you might need to think about.
In her research and on her podcast, Lori explores what the science tells us about how to lead happier and more satisfying lives. And today, she's here to share a set of evidence-based tools for busy educators who may need a wellness tune-up. We'll talk about how to hack your time affluence and how a values mismatch may contribute to teacher burnout. Plus, Lori has advice for getting quick but meaningful resets during the school day. Okay, let's get into it. First of all, what can you tell us about how chronic stress affects teachers' well-being?
Our stress response is a really useful response evolutionarily, but it's there when we need a quick burst of energy to deal with a fast threat that's going to go away. You know, so think a tiger jumping out of the forest at you, right? But then usually the tiger is gone and we sort of shut that off. The problem with the kind of chronic stress that we experience in the educational environment is that it doesn't go away, or maybe it goes away a little bit, you know, Saturday and Sunday, but not really even then, right? Like we're kind of constantly on a level of low-grade stress, and our system is just really not built to deal with that very well.
Now, Lori, you have said that we are part of the problem. Here's what you told the New York Times in 2022. Our minds lie to us. We have strong intuitions about the things that will make us happy, whether it's more money or changing circumstances or buying the new iPhone. But a lot of those intuitions, the science shows, are deeply misguided. Why would our minds be lying to us about what makes us happy?
Well, you know, our minds aren't really evolved to make us happy. They're kind of evolved to detect threats, right? They want to know if there's that tiger hiding around the corner. And that means that we're walking around with minds that are constantly making calculations that wind up making us feel a little bit worse. You know, if you make a certain pay level, you kind of just get used to that. You need a bigger raise to sort of notice any increase in your pay, right? We also have minds that are prone to comparison, right? You find out somebody's doing a little bit better than you, somebody went on a better holiday. Now you kind of feel a little bit crappy about yourself. And all this goes to say that our minds are really out there trying to get us to strive and do more, but they're not necessarily built to make us happy. And that leads to lots of biases that cause us to get things wrong.
So what does the research tell us that our minds actually need to be happy?
Well, in my class, I usually break this down in terms of behaviors that make us happy and mindsets that make us happy. And I think the big ones are things like social connection, doing nice things for others, getting adequate exercise and sleep, which I know for me as an educator, those are the first two things that fall, you know, like by the wayside when I'm feeling a little bit stressed. And even something that researchers call time affluence, the subjective sense that you have some free time. So often we're trying to increase our monetary wealth, where the studies show we'd be happier if we increased our time wealth.
Okay, I want to circle back on time affluence later and talk more about that. But first, you mentioned behaviors that matter for happiness. What about mindsets that help us feel happier?
These are things like developing an attitude of presence, right, where we can be a little bit more mindful about what's going on, developing a sense of gratitude. And then finally, I think as educators, we really need to develop a mindset of self-compassion.
Self-compassion, that is so important and definitely a challenge for many of us. Now, let's talk about what can happen without these habits and mindsets. Earlier, I mentioned a 2025 RAND report where 50% of teachers surveyed said they felt burned out. Of course, this is among the big reasons why teachers are leaving the profession. I'm curious, why do you think burnout is so common amongst educators?
Yeah, well, we mentioned some of the symptoms of burnout when I was chatting about my own experience, right? This sense of emotional exhaustion, a sense of feeling ineffective, a sense that you're feeling really cynical about the folks you're working with. But we didn't talk about the causes. And the researcher Christina Maslach, one of the experts on burnout, has a whole host of occupational causes. We often think that burnout is a problem with ourselves. We think, oh, if I could just like hack it better or get the right work-life balance or whatever, like it's on.
Like I'm just not organized enough as a teacher. So
exactly, right? Like if I could just sort it out, if I was just better, then, you know, this would go away. And what Maslach finds is that we need to start thinking of burnout as an occupational problem. It's something about the interaction between your job and you and your values and so on.
Wait, Lori, what do you mean when you say burnout is an occupational problem?
There's a whole host of things that can go wrong at the occupational level. Maslach talks about things like your workload, right? Your sense of reward. Do you feel like you're really getting rewarded for the work you do? I know this is a problem for teachers, but a real big one that I think we need to discuss for teachers is something that Maslach calls a values mismatch. The idea is that the values that let you get into teaching in the first place are no longer the values you feel like you're executing on a daily basis, right? This is something that I think doctors face hugely, right? You get into this practice to help people be healthier, but you spend so much of your time filling out paperwork, fighting with insurance companies. It's like, when is the patient's health going to matter? And I feel like with teachers, it's the same. It's like there's such a sundry of other BS stuff that you have to work on that feels like, when is this going to be about like just educating these kids and making them really excited to learn? And so, yeah, I think whenever you see that mismatch, you wind up having folks in these occupations experiencing burnout.
I totally agree. And I don't think we talk enough about this values mismatch.
Yes. We know that we need to pay attention to teacher workload and so on. But I think we forget about this sense of purpose and how that might be changing over time in the education system and the impact that might be having on teacher burnout.
In just a little bit, we're going to talk about how to prevent burnout. But first, I want to ask you, what are the consequences for teachers if they just try to push through when they're feeling that way?
Well, it doesn't work. I mean, one of the sad things about burnout is that it kind of just doesn't get better. And the way you need to fix it is to make occupational changes. That either means that you change the values that you bring to your work. You know, you recognize, for example, there are just structural issues in my school or my district that I can't fight, and I'm going to have radical acceptance over that, right? So you change your relationship to the job. You can work with your colleagues in your organization and your district to kind of change some of those things around to make it better. Or you could leave and try a different profession, right? The idea is that burnout doesn't get better unless you make changes.
You know, Laurie, I was thinking a little about my own experience. I was a middle school teacher for 7 years in public schools, and I was feeling very burned out in those last few years, and I had to pull back. So I was, you know, working at 150%, going above and beyond the way that so many teachers do. And I had to, I think, have a moment of like self-forgiveness to say, if I'm going to stay in this work another year, another couple of years, I have to do less. And that was, there was guilt that came with that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when we talk about these pressures that teachers are facing, you know, of course that is happening at the structural level. I think it's also happening at the individual level, right?
Definitely.
How much of the workload is you putting pressure on yourself to do more? And when we don't do that 110%, we beat ourselves up. And so I think developing this mindset of self-compassion and self-forgiveness, where you're trying to take care of yourself, can be incredibly important.
After the break, we'll dig deeper into the science of happiness, and Laurie will tell us why building an emotion regulation team might be better than having a teacher bestie. Okay, be right back.
What does it look like when schools align their practices with the science of how students really learn and grow? How Learning Happens is Edutopia's video series that explores just that, featuring insights from leading experts like Linda Darling-Hammond, Pamela Cantor, and Karen Pittman. You'll see real educators in action applying research-backed strategies that integrate social, emotional, and cognitive development to ensure all students have what they need to thrive. Explore this video series now at edutopia.org/howlearninghappens.
Let's talk more about some specific behaviors and mindsets that can help our well-being, according to the research. And let's start with the idea that higher pay will substantially improve things. You say that's wrong. It's actually more free time that makes us happier.
Well, I'll qualify, because it depends, right? So at really low income levels, getting more money will make you happier, right? And mm-hmm. and you know, let's be real. There are some teachers out there that are just not getting compensated, even at the level that would let them put food on the table, a roof over the head stably, and so on, right? For the teachers that do have that compensation, it is true that more money is probably not going to matter. What does help is sort of focusing on time wealth.
And just to clarify, is this related to how much time you actually have, or is it more about your perception that you don't have enough free time?
This time affluence idea really is more about the subjective sense that you have some free time. And we kind of know this. You know, imagine, like, you know, I don't know, you had some after school meeting that you thought would happen, and then somebody cancels it at the last minute and you just get to go home a half hour early. You're just like stoked. It feels much more meaningful than a half hour, right? That's time affluence at work. Subjectively, it feels amazing, even though objectively it's not that much time. And that means there are ways you can hack your time affluence.
Okay, so what can you do?
One is to use money to buy back time. And research by Ashley Willens at Harvard Business School shows that anytime you can spend that money on something that saves you time, it's a good thing for happiness.
Right. So as your budget allows, I'm thinking of things like outsourcing chores or paying for grocery delivery, things like that. Now, we know that there is something happening when you are pulled in many different directions at once. Your time becomes fragmented into little scraps of downtime that feel too small to use effectively.
Yes.
This is known as time confetti. And I have to say, this feels spot on for teachers, especially secondary teachers who may have 3 or 4 different preps. How does time confetti relate to time affluence?
Time surveys show that we all, like across industries, have more time now than we did 15 or 20 years ago. The issue is that the time we have now is broken up into tinier chunks. And that means we don't experience it as a big expanse of time, partly because when we get this little piece of time confetti, that 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, we don't use it well. We just blow it. You know, usually what I do if I'm not paying attention is I'll pull out my phone and scroll on something, right? That doesn't really give you the sense that you're using the time well.
So for a teacher who takes a 10-minute break between classes to go for a walk instead of scrolling? I mean, is that really enough time to recharge?
I think it really is, right? When you use your time confetti well, you just don't have this franticness feeling, right? But the idea is that you can use that piece of time confetti much more effectively.
While we're talking about small shifts that make an impact, I want to share some suggestions that we received from two teachers in Edutopia's community and hear your thoughts. Cody writes, "Sometimes it's nice to just shut the lights off and take 5 minutes to myself in silence. This can help to clear my head and reset before I go back to work." And Dan does something similar. Every day he tries to do just one thing for himself, like eating lunch without grading. He thinks of it as his way to get some breathing room in his day. What does the research tell us about how strategies like these impact our well-being?
You know, too often when we get a break, one of the things we do with our time confetti is fill it with stuff. It just means that we're constantly being stimulated. So I think the silence can be incredibly helpful. It can just kind of a little bit of a breath.
You know, and it's not just about that time confetti being, say, wasted on scrolling, but it's also like I know teachers feel that constant pressure to be productive.
Yes.
You know, I was a language arts teacher, and so there is always grading to do. And so if I have 10 minutes, I could get through two papers.
Yeah, what we're forgetting is that rest makes us do the rest of our tasks more efficiently.
Mm.
And so I think we just need to kind of reconceptualize how we think about rest as time wasted versus a time that allows us to get more efficient in what we're doing.
Okay, so rest is not optional. And even small breaks in the flow of a busy school day can make a big difference. Now, I want to share another suggestion from a teacher. Her name is Shauna K. Williams-Pinnock, and she writes that she often felt like quitting her high school teaching job, but one thing that helped her thrive despite the challenges was having a teacher buddy.
I would go to them on my tough days, you know, those days when nothing goes as planned and when you start questioning your decision about becoming a teacher. Yeah, those days, they really showed up for me.
What does the research tell us about why work relationships are so important?
They're important for lots of reasons, right? One is we're just at work a lot, right? So if we can get healthy social connection at work, it's just like we're kind of filling in the day with enough of it because we're there for many hours a day. The second reason that connection at work can be so helpful is that this is a person who uniquely understands the struggles that you're going through. So they can provide a really helpful window. I think where this can go wrong, though, is if you wind up in like co-rumination with one another.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
The key is you want to do two things when you're a good friend at work. One is you do want to listen and hear the problems, but you also want to switch into problem solving mode.
Why do you think there is that inclination to get together and to ruminate, to stay there and to not move to that problem solving step?
Yeah, well, this is just something that we all do, right? We have this negativity bias. We're much more likely to see all the hassles than the blessings, right? Those feel really salient to us. And let's be honest, it's a way that people feel like they're bonding when you're griping over something together. But it doesn't ultimately make us feel good, and it ultimately doesn't help us solve problems. One thing that researchers like Ethan Cross often talk about is that, you know, you can kind of use other people to regulate your emotions in different ways. You might want to have that one friend teacher who, like, if you really need a gripe fest, like, they're there. But you might not only want to have that person on your sort of emotion regulation team. You might want to think about who can switch you off it, or who can put you in a good mood, or who's quick to talk about, you know, the things at work they still love.
I love that, an emotion regulation team. Okay, we have talked about making good use of the small breaks we do get, and we've talked about cultivating healthy relationships with colleagues. There is one more strategy from a teacher I want to talk about before we wrap up. At the end of every day before he leaves his classroom, high school ELA teacher Marcus Luther writes down one win in his calendar.
And these wins are very simple. It might just be a great conversation with a student or a colleague, but before I walk out of the room, I just jot down really quickly, here's something that was a win today.
Lori, why might that practice have a real impact?
If you can point your mind to the win and you have a practice of writing it down, you're basically training your attention to notice some of the good things. And that can have a huge effect because oftentimes in all of our jobs, my guess is there's lots of good things. It's just we don't notice them.
And in fact, like the teaching day is just packed
with so many micro moments
yeah.
that when you're looking for just one positive one, you're likely to notice yeah. more.
And if a win feels like too hard, you know, because I think sometimes if we're feeling a real beat down, that feels hard. Switch to another practice that I learned from the poet Ross Gay, which is to find a delight. Like that kid said that one comment in class, or like, you know, so-and-so's shoes just like looked so ridiculous, right? The world is filled with these things if we just open our minds to look for them.
Lori, before we wrap up, I just want to clarify that even though we're trying to rewire some of our mindsets and behaviors, that we're still, of course, going to feel angry and sad and overwhelmed and
totally
afraid at times. And for teachers, like you kind of feel every emotion every yeah. teaching day with all of the kids that you interact with. It would be strange to feel happy all of the time, right? That's not the goal. It's just to clarify.
No. And I'm so glad you brought that up because we don't want to step in a toxic positivity trap, right? It is normative as an educator to be frustrated about stuff. It is normative to be sad about stuff. It's normative to be anxious. It's really normative to feel overwhelmed, right? These are normal emotions, but those emotions can also be regulated.
Okay, Lori, we just talked about some really powerful evidence-based tools that can help teachers, like the practice of pointing your mind towards a win, and I love this one, finding moments of delight every day. Now, I have one last question. Let's return again to your own experience as an educator. I'm curious, which of these tools helped you the most when you were recovering from near burnout?
I really tried to prioritize time affluence. I say no to a lot of things that are otherwise good, but as a finite human, I just have to say no. I feel like for me, it's been recognizing that this is not just like a one and done, but it's kind of a menu of tools that I can use all the time. And I take from that menu every single day to not feel burned out.
Here are three things I'm taking away from this conversation. One, teaching is not an easy job, and the systemic problems are real. But there are some evidence-based shifts that can improve our well-being. Lori suggests building connections with the type of colleagues who help us regulate our emotions, and making excellent use of our time confetti, identifying small wins, or resetting your nervous system. Lights out, door closed. Two. Learn to say no to a lot of otherwise good things. It's easy to fall into the trap of overextending ourselves, pushing ourselves to take on extra work. And so many of us already know how unsustainable that is. And three, try looking for things that feel like a win or inspire gratitude, like Marcus Luther does. If that's too much of a stretch, look for something that simply delights you, like something funny a student says. When we train our brains to see beyond our natural negativity bias, it can really shift the way we experience our time at school. Special thanks to Dr. Lori Santos. To learn more about the science of happiness, check out Lori's podcast, The Happiness Lab. And now there's an online version of our Yale course available for free on Coursera. It's called The Science of Well-Being. We'll link to both in our show notes. Folks, this is our last episode of the season. We're going to take a little summer break, and then we'll be back with new episodes starting in mid-July. If you miss us while we're gone, check out some of our past episodes. I especially loved our conversation with high school science teacher Salim Talili about using drawing to learn. And our math episode with Joe Bowler. As a former ELA teacher, I didn't know that I was going to love that one so much. So check out our archives and be sure to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts so you know when we return. This episode was produced by Anne Noisani and edited by me. Our engineer is Doug Keeley, and our supervising editors are Sarah Gonser and Steve Merrill. Special thanks to Laura DeMars and Paige Tutt. I'm Kristen Leong. We'll see you again soon.